Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back for this very special conversation about the condition of the United States military in what I think of as the war for the free world. We have with us, I'm happy to say, one of the country's preeminent experts on the subject, not just because he's been studying it, but because he has lived and worked in it for decades, in fact, two decades in the United States Marine Corps, rising to the rank of lieutenant colonel. He is Dakota Wood. He is discussing with us today a new book he edited called The 2018 Index of U.S. Military Strength, a remarkable resource, the product of his own good efforts and those of his colleagues at the Heritage Foundation. And Dakota, we've talked about the ground forces. It's stunning how deficient they are and why you've arrived at the conclusion that they would qualify as weak and perhaps an invitation to aggression by our enemies. Describe for us what this seafaring nation, so deeply dependent upon the oceans, both for commerce as well as our security, is currently facing in terms of the readiness, the size, the modernity of our naval forces.
We gave it a marginal score, and it, you know, you would remember under John Layman many years ago that the Navy was trying to build to a 600-ship Navy. Routinely in the 70s and 80s, et cetera, we were between 400 and 450 ships, you know, range of frigates, destroyers, cruisers, aircraft carriers, submarines, and that allowed you to keep roughly 90 to 100 ships on station in many different parts of the world, the Atlantic, Mediterranean, Persian Gulf, et cetera, Western Pacific, and have enough of those ships so that you could rotate those things without wearing out the ships or wearing out the people. And then you would also have enough that if you actually got into a shooting fight and you lost ships, which you should expect in a conventional conflict, you know, with a peer competitor, to be able to replace those combat losses. You know, numbers allow you to sustain operations over time in the face of attrition, of combat losses. Today, instead of 400 or 450 or whatever, we have 275, roughly. The number goes up or down a couple per month. So about 275 ships in the U.S. Navy. We still maintain about the same number deployed. So 90 to 95 ships deployed on an average basis. About two-thirds of those are in the Pacific, so about 60 or thereabouts, 60, 65 in the Pacific. And yet you're doing that with a fleet that's 275 instead of 400. So what that means is a third of the Navy is constantly deployed. To have a ship deployed abroad, since one ship can't be in more than one place at a time, and that ship can't be constantly deployed all the time, you need three or four ships to make it possible to have one out. So you've got one out, one that just got back and going into maintenance, one getting ready to go, and perhaps one ship offline in long-term maintenance. We don't have that ability anymore. It's one out, one back, one getting ready to go, and it's a constant drain on your manpower and resources. And you mentioned a couple of ship collisions this past summer. Part of that was attributed to 100-hour work weeks for the sailors on those ships. When we had the three aircraft carriers recently deployed, the Herculean effort it took to put three aircraft carriers at sea meant that they had to take airplanes from non-deployed squadrons, strip those airplanes out from training squadrons, et cetera, in order to be able to populate the deck. And to get those airplanes up and running, they had to cannibalize other airplanes. So taking a part off of one plane, putting it on another so that you had enough flying aircraft to get it out to sea. The Chief of Naval Operations has recently testified that of the F-18 ENFs, the Super Hornets that are currently in the U.S. Navy Air Arm, half of those are not even flyable. Similar conditions occurs with the Marine Corps. We talked about the January of this past year, two-thirds, I think it was six out of 10, I believe, aircraft, to include helicopters and fixed-wing fighters and cargo planes, six out of 10 weren't even flyable. So you've got half to two-thirds of your air capabilities in the Navy and the Marine Corps that you can't even get out into an operating environment, much less replace combat losses.
So when we talk about all of these statistics, Dakota Wood, we're stupefied by the magnitude of the problem. The size of the force nominally is misleading because actually what's good to go, what could be brought to bear if you need to, certainly in the immediate future, is a fraction of all of that. And again, you've had the experience of planning and executing major operations involving the projection of power, for example, Operations Enduring and Iraqi Freedom. These kinds of statistics must absolutely keep you awake at night, knowing that the world is, as you said now several times, a dangerous place, and perhaps increasingly so. These forces may be needed at any moment. And what will we do should that happen?
Yeah, so yeah, it gives you an idea how mortifying this is when we fielded, you know, arguably the world's best military. I mean, in quality-wise, we still have a marked advantage over the militaries of other countries. But when we field tanks in Iraq and irregular forces like Iraqi insurgents were able to use advanced rocket-propelled grenades or a Cornet anti-tank guided missile, you know, that they got off of the market that's produced by Russia, and those can defeat an Abrams main battle tank, or you use jury-rigged explosives to destroy light-armored vehicles and Humvees, you know, those kinds of things. Can you imagine what the threat would be like going up against an actual trained professional Russian, Iranian, or Chinese force? So we just haven't experienced or really thought about what kind of losses you should expect in actual major conflict. We've been watching what Russia's been doing in Ukraine with thermobaric warheads, multiple launch rocket systems, advanced field artillery, et cetera. And our guys just haven't had to think about or to deal with that kind of a threat. So the smaller a force you have, the more sensitive it is to combat losses. And the technological advantage only gives you a bit of an advantage for a period of time. But your thinking enemy is going to find ways around that. They'll bring the fight in closer. And in an attrition fight and having a small force, you're really putting put a lot of risk on your capabilities. So this idea of having enough and having it modern is important.
It is really important. And especially when, as you say, Dakota Wood, the militaries that we may confront have, to varying degrees, been testing out this equipment, not just in the normal sense of the word, but, you know, much as Hitler and Mussolini did in Spain prior to World War II, Ukraine and in Syria and places like that. You've actually seen these guys going for it and finding out what works and how to refine it. So that makes it that much more formidable a threat.
Yeah, I think it's a great example you provide. You know, Spanish Civil War, people were trying, the Germans were trying out dive bomber tactics and how to machine guns, how do you employ them, and all that sort of thing. And the Middle East has become that same kind of testing ground for the countries that you just mentioned. So in 2008, when Russia went into Georgia, it had miles of strung out, broken down vehicles, just hugely embarrassing, but it revealed to them how poor their military had gotten. When they took Crimea, much better, moved into Ukraine proper, much better than that. I've gone into the Middle East and Syria, and they're doing long-range 1,000-mile cruise missile shots out of the Caspian Sea into Syria and long-range shots out of the Mediterranean. So since the end of, 1992 or thereabouts, our spending in real terms as a percentage of GDP has gone up about 16%. Most of that is attributable to the increased cost of manpower. You know, our benefits, medical care, salaries, and stuff just consume a huge amount of that that money that's been spent. I think 60% of the Marine Corps budget is manpower costs alone. Russia has increased its spending 60%, 60, and China, since that same period, has increased their spending 650%.
Yeah, double-digit growth year upon year upon year. It adds up. And as they say, to your point about, you know, our maintaining sort of a qualitative edge, as I think it was Stalin who said, the quantity has a quality all its own. And we're watching that coming into bear. When we come back, we're going to talk with Dakota Wood about the other element of our air forces, namely the United States Air Force itself, our nuclear forces, and other important capabilities right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.